The next case is 06-2029, Donna J. Stewart versus the Lake County Historical Society. Mr. Fitzgerald.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Tim Fitzgerald. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, the Lake County Historical Society, and request that the court reverse the decision of the 11th Appellate District in this case. Mr. Chief Justice, may I reserve 3 minutes for my time for rebuttal?
Your time.
I will. Thank you very
Counsel,
much.
Counsel, how is this case different from Holly Hill?
On the open and obvious issue, it is not much different in any respect, Your Honor.
So what would we have to write?
It relates differently in terms of the Americans with Disabilities Act impact as to whether or not the standard itself that's found in the ADA accessibility guidelines would apply to an individual like
me. So essentially the same question, it's just whether it's the building code or the ADA guidelines, but it's the same.
The analysis would be the same.
The analysis is the same. It's just a different code book that you're referring to.
That is correct. But it is a distinct issue because the question of whether or not the standard even applies to Mrs. Stewart or a non-disabled person like Mrs. Stewart was not addressed in Lang versus Holly Hill.
If we conclude that the Court of Appeals was incorrect in its conclusion on open and obvious, we still need to, in your view, decide the other issue, the issue of the building standard.
Not necessarily. If the court were to determine that the open and obvious doctrine applied here, as it did in Holly Hill,
right,
that would, in essence, negate the duty element that was would have been owed, as in Holly Hill, would result in judgment in favor of Lake County Historical Society. But the question also must be addressed in terms of the ADA is whether or not an individual who is not disabled can still rely upon a guideline that's issued pursuant to the ADA to establish the duty element. And
the building code encompassed the ADA specifications. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Is there any other code section or part of this code that deals with ramps?
Not that was
Is there a different way of building a ramp other than the ADA specifications that are incorporated in the building code?
Not that that's been argued in this case, Your Honor. The issue is, I think that's part of the issue, is that there may be circumstances where a ramp would be built that would not be subject to the ADA guidelines.
Such as commercial ramp or something.
Private property, things of that nature, where if the 11th District's decision here is allowed to stand and it's used as evidence of the standard of care, the ADA guidelines could be, and indeed probably would be, applied to those circumstances where the ADA was never intended to even have any application.
But in this particular case, based on what it was, which was a schoolhouse for tourists or students. It was built for the purpose of not making it easier or more fun or whatever the reason is for the kids to get up the ramp. It was for disabled.
There's no doubt that this ramp was constructed with the idea of allowing access by handicapped individuals. And so there hasn't been an argument made that the ADA does not apply here. But the question is, and it's very clear from the statutes and from the administrative code that incorporates the accessibility guidelines, that when the ramp is constructed according to that provision, that 4.82 of the accessibility guidelines, that it is done, and it's with the intent that it be done for purposes of allowing access for those persons with disabilities. Here, Mrs. Stewart was not disabled. It's been stipulated that she was not in any way disabled under either the ADA or the Ohio definition of disability. And therefore, under the established law of this court, most recently in the Hack versus Gillespie case, and going back to the Horning Railway Company case, 1910, in order to be to utilize a standard that is articulated in either a statute or a regulation, the plaintiff must be a member of the class that it's intended to be protected by that statute. So clearly, if Mrs. Stewart is not disabled, and she's using a ramp that she had used repeatedly for at least the previous year, she is not entitled to the use of the guidelines to establish what the standard of care would be in a general negligence premises liability case.
If she were pushing someone in a wheelchair, would she be within that protected class when she fell? Or is it only the person in the wheelchair that you think is within that protected class?
Well, I think that is, I think that can be answered by reference to a previous decision from this court, which is the Bennett versus Stanley case, which is a 2001 case, where this court recognized the attractive nuisance doctrine for children. And there the court said that if the attractive nuisance doctrine applies to children, and somebody is, an adult is trying to rescue that child from the attractive nuisance, in that case it was a swimming pool, that the adult, even though they are not entitled to the attractive nuisance doctrine standard as an adult, if they are brought within the scope of the doctrine itself, then yes, they would assume the standard of would be applied to the child. So I would submit that in the proper case, under...
So you're suggesting that it can be expansive in some instances?
It could be, but again...
Why wouldn't we expand it to those users of the ramp who were accessing the building for other purposes? We could expand it to that extent, could we not?
Well, again, that would require that the court go outside of what the court has said is the proper scope for statutory or regulatory standards like this, that you have to be within the class of persons who are intended to benefit from the statute. I would submit that it would not...
I guess that's what I'm trying to define. Where do you find a definition of the class of persons intended to be benefited by the statute?
By this particular...
revised code. I look to find out who constitutes that class.
3781.111A and B defines the fact that when the state of Ohio decided to incorporate the ADA admissibility guidelines into the building code, it is done with the intention that it be done for the benefit of disabled individuals. It provides that directly in the statute, as well as in the administrative code section that actually incorporates the ADA accessibility guidelines. So that is the statutory framework as to how that accessibility guideline is incorporated.
So Mr. Fitzgerald, if the plaintiff here were disabled, the open and obvious doctrine would not be a defense to the duty owed to her under the ADA, is that correct?
No, under Lange, the open and obvious would still be a viable defense, even to a disabled individual, because again, the guidelines that we're talking about here are not statutory. This is not a Robinson v. Bates type of scenario where the standard is statutory, like the Landlord-Tenant Act. What we're dealing with here is a regulatory, just exactly it was at issue in the Holly Hill case, that's incorporated into the building code. There, it involved the height of the risers of the steps and the absence of a handrail. And so even though this is a different part of the building code, it is still regulatory. And Lange would dictate that even for a disabled individual, the open and obvious would still apply.
I'd like to take it to the duty. It seems to me the duty issue here is the critical issue. And you argue that that there's no duty going from the Historical Society to the plaintiff here because the plaintiff was not disabled, and therefore the building code regulation did not apply. It was not for her benefit. Is there not also a relevance issue? Evidence whether it's relevant or not to the. I've got them mixed in my mind. I'd like you to try to unmix them for me.
Well, I think the relevance question would only come into play based on the applicability to a particular case. But what we're asking for is a broader determination that because they were not within the class of persons, the relevance issue doesn't even become an inquiry for the court to decide.
There's no duty there. Obviously, relevance is not an issue.
That's right. And in this case, we would submit that the way these accessibility guidelines are implemented by way of an administrative process that to allow those code provisions to become a standard of care for the general public grants a great deal of authority to an administrative body to define for the state of Ohio what the standard of care is going to be when really the administrative body that's determining those guidelines is only concerned with those guidelines that are applicable to the disabled. Here the guidelines are articulated by a federal agency called the U.S. Access Board, which is consisted of members of the public appointed by the president, as well as various federal agencies like the Department of Justice, the Department of the Interior, the VA, all sit on this board. And to allow them to articulate based on their view of what is appropriate for access for the disabled to apply generally to members of the public is, contrary to what this court recognized both in Lange and in Chambers, that we don't want to have administrative bodies being the ones making policy decisions that change the standard of or burden of proof.
So it wouldn't matter how far off the standard the slope in this ramp is. It could be half an inch off. It could be three. It could be 10 inches off. In your view, it doesn't matter. That's the relevance issue, I guess. Is it always a duty issue? Because it could be that a ramp that's 10 inches off standard could be difficult for a non-disabled person to navigate. In that instance, you could argue, well, it's relevant for the fact finder to know that, and that could be an element of the Historical Society's duty to provide a safe entrance to the building.
Well, I would submit that the evidence that a ramp was 10 inches or of significance difference in the slope would be evidence that would come in, but it wouldn't come in by way of the accessibility guidelines for the disabled. It would be a factor that the court would decide or the jury would decide based on that evidence.
Well, counsel, that would be relevant if that ramp were the only access here. And
correct.
Both able and disabled individuals were forced to use it. But there were steps, were there not?
Correct.
And she could have, and in fact, this was, as you stated, built specifically to fulfill the needs established by the ADA.
Correct.
I guess there was some testimony that the engineer or the expert looked at it and said, just by looking at these pictures, I can see that it is not up to code.
The slope exceeded the ADA guidelines. That is correct, and we would submit that plays into the open and obvious issue here, which is that it's and there's case law from the appellate districts in Ohio that we've cited in our briefs that talk about the fact that a ramp, the slope of a ramp is as stairs are frequently recognized to be the hazard that is observable to the pedestrian and should be taken into account in terms of how they conduct themselves. So,
but if this individual had been repeatedly using this ramp, then the fact that it's not in accord with ADA guidelines or standards, according to the expert, is really irrelevant, is it not?
For purposes of the open and obvious defense, that is right. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the slope itself was known to Mrs. Stewart from her having used it, and even from the expert's own recognition that the slope could be observed from just, he only had access to the photographs. She was there physically on a regular basis using the ramp, and therefore was charged with knowing what the slope of the ramp was. So
counsel,
we would submit that is sufficient to invoke the open and obvious defense and bar this claim.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to the building code regulations for a moment. Is your argument that that these building code regulations regulating the slope are only applicable to people with disabilities, so that if you don't have a disability, there are no building code regulations regulating the slope of a ramp?
That have been argued in this case. This is the only the only provision of the building code that relates to the slope of this ramp that has been argued by the plaintiff in this case. Whether there might be other provisions that would come into play have not been.
Well, wouldn't that be a relevant question? If even though the purpose might have been to incorporate the ADA standards, once they are incorporated into a building code and they're the only regulations that regulate the ramp in public situations like this, let's just limit it to that, why wouldn't they apply to everybody? If they're not two separate standards, why wouldn't the building code regulations apply to everybody?
That was the purpose. Your Honor, I'm out of time. May I answer?
Yeah, sure, you may answer.
The legislation and the administrative code provision that incorporate the ADA accessibility guidelines clearly say that it is for the benefit of the disabled. There would be no reason for either the legislation or the administrative code provision to limit it to the disabled if it was intended to apply globally. And
But the consequence of that argument is then there are no regulations relating the slope of ramps for anybody other than those that would be fall within the category of disabled. Would that be a logical consequence?
Well, that is what our argument is, and the flip side is that for non-disabled person, the slope of the ramp is governed by the common law standard of what is reasonable under the circumstances as to whether or not that slope is excessive and poses an unreasonable risk to individuals generally who are not disabled.
Are there any cases that have held where there are not two separate standards, you just merge? Is there any case that supports what you just argued to Justice Cupp?
Not from the state of Ohio. I mean, there are cases that recognize that the ADA accessibility guidelines are not evidence of negligence in a general premises liability case like this,
if Ohio hadn't incorporated it, we would still have ADA regulations, and then your argument would have more force.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
If Ohio hadn't incorporated the ADA standards into its building code, the ADA standards could be enforced for ramps, and we would have building code regulations, and your argument might have more force. I think Justice Cupp's point is, once they merge, we have a building code that applies to everyone, including disabled.
Well, but that's not what the legislation says. I mean, the legislation says that it's designed and it's incorporated for purposes of allowing access to the premises for those who are disabled. And it isn't merged as a general statement of a standard that applies to all ramps under all circumstances. It's those ramps that are designed to allow access for the disabled. So in the ramp that's on the private property, not governed by the ADA accessibility guidelines, would not be subject to those building codes. And that is a policy decision that has been made by the legislature and by the Building Standards Commission that's the way these guidelines are to apply.
And you reject the idea that they could be evidence of what is reasonable under the circumstances?
Yes. And the reason is because the guidelines applicable to the disabled do not have general applicability to the public in general. In other words, would have
applicability to ramps in general.
But that's not what the
understand. I understand. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Todd Peterson. I am pleased to represent Donna Stewart before your court today. I think if we were looking at this from a different direction and the lower court had granted summary judgment in our favor based upon the ADA guidelines being violated, I think we'd be in a different situation. But here we're talking about a standard that already exists, which is to exercise ordinary care and to warn of latent and or concealed defects if there is knowledge or imputed knowledge. And all we are suggesting is that the ADA guidelines, as incorporated into the building code, are evidence. Evidence, that's all, not per se.
But we've already rejected that argument in finding that the building code is not a standard of reasonableness when you have open and obvious.
I want to separate those for a second. Where open and obvious exists, I understand in Lang versus Holly Hill, I had the opportunity to review the video archive of that just yesterday, and I understand open and obvious is alive in this situation, if it's open and obvious, but there still has to be the determination of the fact that it is, in fact, open and obvious.
Aren't the standards that are established for ADA very different than a person who is not disabled, could navigate? I mean, they're designed for wheelchairs and for people who need a lower slope, but somebody who is not disabled in any way can navigate things that are very different. And so I don't understand how it can be reasonable for a non-disabled person as a standard when they're really designed for people who cannot navigate the normal circumstances.
Allow me to tie that into an answer to a question asked in the appellant's argument. It would be, I'm unaware of any situation where the ADA creates the accessibility, creates the standard for which that accessibility is to be created or constructed, puts it in the Ohio Building Code, and then the Ohio Building Code overrules it or says it should be done differently. This isn't a situation where the ADA said, you need a ramp, and then the Ohio, the building department, whoever, said, here's how you build it. The ADA said, you need to build it, and here's how you need to build it. Accessibility is one thing. I can understand that if this was an accessibility issue, it wasn't built in the first place, Ms. Stewart would have no basis for bringing a cause of action. This is how it was constructed, and I think exactly the point of your questions was the fact that it's there, and I cited in my brief, if somebody's pushing a wheelchair, if somebody's assisting a friend, if somebody's cleaning, as Ms. Stewart was, she was clearly an intended user. She literally was cleaning on a regular basis.
But again, my point is a standard of reasonableness, which ADA is designed for somebody who's disabled, is not the same as a person who is not disabled. They can navigate things very comfortably, without difficulty, without the ADA, you know, very small slopes, you know, everything that you need to make sure that they can access it. That's not designed for the person who doesn't have a disabled. So I can't understand why you say that's a reasonable standard to be applied to a non-disabled person.
If I understand your question correctly, I think you're suggesting that if it is safe for a handicapped person, it must be safe for a non-handicapped person.
No, I'm saying the opposite. I'm saying a non-handicapped person can navigate obstacles in everyday ordinary situations that are difficult for disabled persons. So when you set standards at the lowest threshold for a disabled person, that is a threshold way below the reasonableness standard for a person who's not handicapped.
I think that depends specifically on what the standard is, what the application is, and I think that would go to the weight of the evidence, and that's exactly what I'm asking here. This is a situation for the jury. We have the general rule, and I think that each time we peck away at it, we have jurors capable of handling the issue of what is reasonable, what is ordinary care, and I don't think that our jury instructions at the end of the case ought to be longer than our presentation of proof during the case.
How would you instruct a jury on a reasonable standard for a disabled person should be applied to a non-disabled person? How would you instruct the jury on that?
How would I instruct that this standard? I think during the presentation, as I would see it going through the presentation of proof in the trial, the expert would come on, he would explain what the guidelines are. He would suggest that in this case, 1 to 12 is the appropriate slope. And in fact, in this case, it was 2.5 to 12, so 2.5 times the appropriate slope for the ramp. And then he would build upon that to suggest, for instance, using examples of everyday life. Get on a treadmill, be at 1 degree or 1 to 12, and then be on a treadmill at 2.5 to 12 and tell me if there's a difference. It's one building block of evidence. It's certainly not going to carry the day, but that's not the situation here. And again, that's why I say it's a different circumstance if they grant summary judgment in favor of Ms. Stewart and we come here today. I think in that case, certainly it would be appropriate to overturn it. But that's not what we're saying. All we need to do is show a genuine issue of material fact to survive summary judgment, and to be back before a jury.
Counsel, if you get back to the root question that the chief stated, that the critical issue here is duty, and if you have a statute that is outlining who these guidelines, or not guidelines, but who these standards are to apply to, why is that, how do you argue there's a duty then?
If built appropriately, any public building is going to have, these days, a ramp and steps. To my knowledge, those ramps don't have a sign on them that say, restricted to handicap use only. They are contemplated as being used by able-bodied individuals, and they ought to be safe for access by not only disabled individuals, but by able-bodied individuals. Let me give you an example. In much the same way, what about a grab bar in a restroom? A grab bar is installed pursuant to the ADA. The grab bar is in fact, installed under the guidelines of the ADA as incorporated into the basic building code, not just to be there, but in the manner in which it's fastened to the wall. An able-bodied individual uses the restroom, grabs onto the grab bar comes, tears loose from the wall because it didn't meet the standards of the ADA. I think that that would be evidence that it was not installed properly and therefore could be used in the trial to say that injuries were caused as a result.
But so you're saying that the statute that defines who this was intended to cover is irrelevant here?
No. I certainly don't want to say that. What I want to say is this. The ADA, as its guideline, said for accessibility. And I think the ADA, if we were arguing an accessibility case, Ms. Stewart could not avail herself of that because she is not qualified as disabled at that point in time. What I'm saying is once you get past the accessibility issue, it would be unreasonable to expect that some other board is going to create a separate standard for how that ramp, once mandated by the ADA, is going to be built for able-bodied persons. It's going to flow that they're going to mandate it for accessibility purposes and then say how it's to be built, contemplating use by both disabled and non-disabled individuals.
Counsel, on the issue of open and obvious, was this disputed by the parties?
It was disputed by the parties. Certainly, but let me say this. Both courts agreed that the open and obvious didn't apply. And it wasn't a legal inquiry. It was a factual inquiry. And they said this. They didn't argue that, the complaint didn't argue that she fell as a result of it being wet or pooled water. The complaint specifically said that it was the manner in which it was constructed, which here would have been the slope. And both courts agreed that as a result, the slope is not something that is open and obvious. And I think there was an example in Lang, and I'll bring it back up in this one, that what if there was a standard with respect to the number of trusses in a floor?
I'm having difficulty hearing you. Can you speak in the microphone?
There was an example in the Lang argument that What if there was a standard that said how many trusses had to be in a floor? Somebody safely walks across the floor any number of times, ultimately falling through that floor. It's similar here. It's one thing to say that an engineer takes a look at the photos and says, that's outside of the ADA guidelines, it's clearly too steep. I don't think that's something that we could expect from a layperson. Any number of people could look at scientific diagrams and tell me what they meant, and I couldn't look at them and tell you the same thing. 1 to a 12 slope versus 2.5 to a 12 slope, I don't know that that's something that we can clearly say is open and obvious. I don't know how to say it other than that looking at it, especially when I'm walking down it, I don't look at it from the side, and at the same time I'm walking at it, see what the slope is. It's going to be probably imperceptible from a visual standpoint.
But if it's designed for the disabled, why is it not open and obvious to someone who's not disabled? I mean,
it's not
the
open.
Rationale of the Court of Appeals opinion. I'm having difficulty with the rationale Court of Appeals opinion when it found that this is not an open and obvious case. It seems to me that for someone to have to check the building standards in order to know whether it's open and obvious, that's obviously not logical, not possible. But that seems to be the gist of what the Court of Appeals is saying, is it not, in its opinion? Or do you read it differently?
No, Your Honor, but if I understand your question, and I may be wrong, you're suggesting that by virtue of it being a ramp, it has some degree of open and obvious danger. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, that she sees the ramp, and the ramp is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I mean, it seems to me in this instance, you can certainly argue that, as you know, that it's the ramp is the ramp. She sees the ramp, and if it's defective, it's obvious. I mean, it has the slope that by which it's been constructed. It's not like there's a hole in it or something that is open and obvious in that sense. But here there's I guess I don't understand the rationale for saying that's not.
You know, I suggested one thing. There's actually, when I look at a ramp, I suggested in my brief that if I look at a handicap accessible ramp, that to me suggests actually some additional modicum of safety or looking at a handicap ramp, the first thing I think of isn't danger or open and obvious problems with traversing it. And you know, we're talking about the difference between 1 to 12 slope versus 2.5 times that. And again, I don't know that we can expect a layperson looking at it to say, that's, you know, wow, that's a danger. I can't possibly make it up, especially when in practice it had been safely traversed. I think this is something that very clearly, and I will say this, I inherited this case, but I think more could have been done in some of the briefing down below by the experts, but there's evidence in the record that would be sufficient to elaborate upon, certainly at trial, for the purpose of saying, here, it's a violation. There's some evidence that it's unreasonable at that point. But here, let me go on further to say it. Remember, this is summary judgment proceedings. We're talking about disposing of it pretrial without a full presentation of all the facts and all the testimony. And I think that at that point, it's unreasonable. If this was in trial, and we were here on weighing the testimony before a jury, I couldn't tell you it was against, you know, that the jury had no right to decide this way. But I'm telling you, what I'm saying at this point is, on a summary judgment motion, when we're talking about the standards to simply survive it, there was enough here to go to the jury. Have an opportunity before the jury to bring in other witnesses, bring eyewitnesses, bring your additional expert testimony, have the expert elaborate upon it. But under no circumstances is a summary judgment an appropriate place, nor really a possible place to have lengthy voluminous recitations of testimony and evidence.
Mr. Peterson, let me ask you the question that Justice Pfeiffer began with Mr. Fitzgerald. Is this a Holly Hill case?
Is it in terms of the open and obvious?
Well, exactly.
One, I disagree that it's open and obvious. Okay. One, it has to be open, and two, it has to be obvious, and I've given my reason why. Looking at a ramp, especially when you're traversing it, so you're on the face of it, I can't say open and obvious. That takes it out of there. But in terms of being an administrative regulation as evidence of negligence,
yes,
I can't find any good reason in this case to get rid of a general rule that says an administrative regulation is evidence of negligence. We start parsing it, you can imagine that. We start parsing it at this point by saying, going beyond that general rule of what administrative regulations can, you know, constitute evidence, simple evidence. And we take the weighing of that evidence out of the jury, and then we start saying when it can be considered and for whom, we're going to be in a morass of rulings and opinions that it's going to be tough to sort out. I mean, we have a good general rule. Let's stick to the general rule. It's evidence of negligence. We have capable people in our jury pool. Allow them to hear it and allow them to decide. That's all I'm asking.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, I'll sit down with 34 seconds left.
Thank you, Mr. Peter. That's a rare event here. Mr. Fitzgerald, you've exceeded your time by quite a bit. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just two quick points. The issue in this case, as Chief Justice Moyer has pointed out, is it's a duty question. Duty is always an issue of law. We don't submit the questions of what is the law to the jury or to experts, and that is exactly what Mr. Peterson has suggested would happen here, is that we're going to open this up to allow experts to say what the law is, what administrative code provisions apply, what don't, and try to distinguish those legal issues. That's for the court to decide, and that's why this is an issue that the court needs to address in terms of whether or not an individual is disabled or not disabled as to whether the accessibility guidelines apply. The second, on the open and obvious issue, Yes, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals rejected the open and obvious defense. They did so by saying it was not applicable. Now, why did the Court of Appeals say that it was not applicable? At paragraph 24 of the opinion, it says that the reason that it's not applicable is because the ADA guidelines apply. That's exactly what Lange said does not happen. So the Court of Appeals opinion here is inconsistent with Lange, and it's not an issue of whether or not it was obvious and open to Mrs. Stewart. It's whether or not the guidelines were known to Mrs. Stewart, and that is not what the issue is or the inquiry is on the open and obvious defense. With that, we would ask that the court reverse the 11th District Court of Appeals and enter judgment in favor of the Lake County Historical Society. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.